Welcome to the Canadian Tech Podcast, episode 56 for Wednesday, January the 20th, 2016. My name is Stuart Clark.
My name is Derek Silva.
And my name is Jameson Roberts.
Welcome back, gentlemen. It's another cold, cold day here in southwestern Ontario. We definitely got spoiled with the weather earlier on in the year.
El Nino can come back anytime it wants.
Yep. Well, at least we're not getting the blizzard that the East Coast is supposed to be getting. So,
or the squalls that they're getting up in like Exeter over to Kitchener, like it's actually pretty bad. Just not that far north of us.
Our good friends in Listowel got 60 centimeters, I heard.
So. They can keep it.
They can keep it. Exactly. I'm sure the snowblowers are going well there. Okay, we got a ton of topics today. We got a bunch of stories, everything from wireless to Netflix to Nest to you name it, we have it. So let's get started. Multi-carrier SIM cards. I've been hearing about multi-carrier SIM cards for years, but it sounds like it might be a little bit closer, Derek.
Yeah, so first of all, Microsoft is apparently building its own their own SIM cards that will be available for Windows 10 devices and in Google Fi? Mm-hmm. And Google Fi form would work with multiple carriers. And help Microsoft, I guess, break away from carriers or at least offer a better service, Google Fi type service. And of course, Google Fi itself and that model, multi-carrier SIM cards, would really help things move forward and provide greater redundancy, better competition, better network performance. You know, if your SIM card can realize, hey, Bell's not very good in this area, who else can I connect to? Oh, look, there's Rogers or Telus or Wind or MTS if you're out in Manitoba. Okay, just switch and go, and you're not going to get raked over the coals by roaming rates or what have you. It's just all built into your plan. This would be great. And of course, you know, eventually switching to Wi-Fi when it's available, if that's your best option, that would be even better because you get great upload and download in most cases. And because you're so close to the access point, typically a much stronger and more reliable connection. This is starting to happen now. It's what Google Project Fi does.
It's what Apple's been proposing for a couple of years, even because they've been trying to get carriers to switch over to this idea for a long time, and unfortunately, we're stymied so much that they just had to reduce the size of the SIM card. You mentioned like being raked over the coals for roaming. I think it's more important for people who travel. I can think of nothing better than being able to load up a card from Europe, and when I'm across the pond, hey, there I'm on some network over there, and there's never any break in my connectivity or how my workflow on my mobile device works.
Yeah, like if you could get Vodafone and, let's say, Telus together on the same SIM card, you'd be covered here, and then Vodafone would cover you in like another 20 or 30 countries.
It would certainly eliminate the hassle of either having to purchase a fully unlocked phone or a spare phone just to take that you can throw a SIM into when you're going abroad in the U.S. I've worked at places where we've had staff, and yeah, that's exactly what they've had to do. Yeah. I guess the big question is, you know, the Bells, Rogers, and that of the world, if there's less incentive for people to buy a phone that's tied in, are we going to be looking at a point one day when there's not going to be, you know, hardware rates, and people are just going to be buying unlocked phones.
We're already looking at that. If you look at news from south of the border not too long ago, I believe it was Verizon or AT&T have completely killed off phone subsidies.
Yeah.
So that you pay this phone subsidy separately if you're going to pay it off. It's, you know, they're treating it more like a loan from a bank. You pay off a little bit per month, but it's not related to your plan, which I think is almost a better solution because I'm with Carrier X here in Canada. I can have a plan that does what I need it to and hopefully doesn't rake me over the coals cost-wise. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I can pay off the phone in 16 months because I know that in 16 months there's going to be a new iPhone or a new device coming out that I want.
Yeah, well, like, so Kudo kind of started that with the Kudo tab a few years ago, and that's exactly what Wind does. Like, it, you know, they'll give you a subsidized phone at the beginning, but you're paying it off. You're not actually on a contract. I can leave Wind at any time. I'll have to pay for the rest of the phone, but that's fine. That's completely reasonable. It actually really bothers me that there are still companies, mostly here in Canada, who have these two or three-year, well, I guess you can't do 3-year contracts anymore, but 2-year contracts. And, you know, if I decide to leave early, I have to pay this massive early termination fee. And I just, it is such an outmoded thinking, like, well, we have to snag these people for 2 or 3 years to make it worth our while. It's like, well, then just maybe you should just make us pay for the actual service up front, what it actually costs you, plus a 10 to 15% net margin. Like, I expect companies to make money. That's not the issue. The issue is feeling like I'm getting nickel and dimed, or I'm getting penalized because somebody else is giving a better deal. That's not my fault. That's your fault.
Yep.
I should be able to move freely around.
Alternately, and this ties into our next story, if the companies were less worried about holding on to someone for 2 years so they have a guaranteed revenue stream, and were more concerned about actually offering great service at reasonable prices for everyone and being competitive in their pricing, they would probably have less problems holding on to customers and less of this fear of losing tons of them if something happens and needing to have people locked in.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's an excellent segue into our next story, which I actually moved up a bit, because last week we talked about Rogers and Bell raising the rates, and I mused poetic, saying, gee, how long until TELUS does that? And guess what, guys? I'm psychic.
2 days. It took two days.
Two days.
They took a little bit longer to push the code changes.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. So TELUS did theirs as well. Or when they were drawing the straws in that secret meeting, they drew the third straw. That was my outside voice again.
Yes.
But the other thing I find interesting, and as we were saying pre-show, a lot of these things they talk about, oh, it's because of the dollar and stuff like that. A lot of it's BS, because if you notice in markets like Saskatchewan and I believe Manitoba, where there is a fourth legitimate provider, those rates haven't gone up.
Yeah, and neither has Wind, which is the next closest thing to a national competitor. Their plans are still at $35 for the plan that I have, unlimited data, but full speed up to 2 gigabytes, which is plenty. Unlimited Canada-wide calling, unlimited Canada and US-wide texting. You're still getting credits if you bring your own phone. And with the Wind tab, you get up to $600, depending on your credit and all that, and you get voicemail. So that's still $35 a month. They still have a $25 a month talk and text plan with unlimited pretty much everything except for data. There's no data in the plan. So, this whole thing about, oh, well, it's exchange rates, and, you know, we're spending money to build out our infrastructure still, that's fine. The expansion thing I can buy, except that except that their networks all cover already 92-93% of the population. Yeah. So unless they're extending it to 100, and that's where all this money's going, that's not a very good excuse.
And I think the other thing too is, and again, we've seen it too, like I've particularly for Bell and Rogers, like there's less people going with the traditional TV cable package. Like, we dropped cable years ago, but because of that, our internet uses has risen. So there's a lot of companies now that used to have unlimited plans where now they're scaling that back. You know, it is, you know, people talk about a finite resource, but I think that's what's happening, is they're trying to adjust their model to keep their share price up, because, essentially for Rogers, it's their cable side, and for Bell, I think it's DSL and their landlines. Less and less people, which used to be a cash cow, are subscribing to that. So they're having to find more creative ways to keep the margins up. But it's really unfortunate we don't have decent competition here, and I wish the CRTC would have some teeth here.
Well, and I was going to say, like, Derek, you mentioned that, you know, the expanding market share, like having to increase coverage and things like that is a means for, you know, them needing to keep their prices high. I don't particularly buy that because at this point we've already got huge fiber infrastructures in a lot of Canada, certainly not the rural areas, but in the areas where they're putting in new LTE towers and things like that. All of that infrastructure is already in there. And if you take a look at the cost of the hardware for LTE, it's year over year, it drops. It's the same thing with new fiber technology. It always drops in price.
Yeah.
So they're essentially just trying to pad their books, even though the cost of them upgrading their network is probably lower than what it was 5 years ago, and they're able to put in better technology. So I think it's a tired excuse for companies that are unwilling to actually compete.
I would generally agree. And when the dollar rose significantly against the US dollar back in, well, just very recently, back in like 08, 09 through the Great Recession, and we were at par or even trading above a bit above par against the US dollar, did our rates go down 5, 10, or 15%?
Nope.
No. So,
that's the whole thing on the nature of business, whether, you know, everything's tied to quarterly share price now, and that's the problem. And
because, that is definitely the best measure of a business's success.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We could go for hours from that, but we should move on. I know, because we all love to rant about that one. Those two stories, we could have their own series of shows.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
Every week.
Okay. Speaking of cutting cable on that, our good friends at Netflix, in addition to announcing they are going to a shootload of countries. Notice I didn't say the other word.
130 countries now?
130, wow. That's pretty good. They're also announcing they're going to crack down on people who use VPN software to pick up Netflix from other countries. In case some people don't know, Netflix Canada is different from Netflix US, is different from Netflix UK, mostly because of those darn licensing and rights issues.
Yeah.
So in the past, they've kind of, it's just nudge, nudge, wink, wink. People set up a VPN software and make it look like they're in England or the US, and that were seem to be the more popular ones. They're saying they're going to start blocking that. So you're going to have to be in the country itself. How do you think the market's going to react to this?
I personally think that either the VPN creators are just going to get a little bit more inventive. More importantly, I think that people are probably just not going to stand for it. I think you're really going to see people just saying, well, I'm going to go back to cable. Don't know. But more importantly, you'll probably see usage go down just because people aren't getting the content they want. And unfortunately, the studios doing all the licensing can't seem to get their heads out of their butts for seeing that people want access to their content. And
I think you're going to see torrenting use go back up.
Yep.
Because we've seen some good examples where Netflix has put on something major, and you see the pirating go down. Because again, people have no problem paying for something, and I've said this for years. Whether it's Steam or Apple,
iTunes,
whatever, people have no problem paying for something if it's easy to get.
Yeah. Well, I will say personally, this is not going to impact me. I have debated trying to get Netflix US, but I thought, you know what? I'm just going to pay. I'm going to support, the fact that Netflix is here in Canada and watch the Canadian content. And it has 99% of the stuff I want to watch anyway.
Yeah, that's exactly what we find as well. There's never been a need for us.
Yeah, I mean,
my wife's the big user of Netflix, and I've told her.
Well, and like for us, we've got Netflix, but we've also just started paying for Crunchyroll because we've been watching a lot of anime. And Crunchyroll is essentially Netflix for anime.
Yeah.
And so it's a case of, well, now we're getting even more content in the same format. It's not necessarily going to impact us. For me personally, not family-wise, one thing that really frustrates me about Netflix in Canada is the lack of a large catalog of sci-fi. I'm a big sci-fi guy. Mm-hmm. And if you take a look at the US, there is significantly more. And so it's one of those things where I've used a VPN to access Netflix, in the US, and it frustrates me to see that there are still so many executives so paranoid of this thing called the internet and essentially global access and global rights, which are already there.
Yeah, well, I mean, part of it is that the rights ultimately belong up here to a lot of shows on, like, Space Network, to, what, Bell, I guess, right? Bell owns Space.
Yep. I think so.
So, and Bell wants to make money off of Crave TV, and I think they're putting some shows on Show Me as well. And, I mean, that's okay. What I don't want to do is end up paying $40 a month again for, you know, four or five different streaming services. Now, obviously, a monopoly isn't necessarily great either, but why is there Crave and Show Me? Like, why can't...
Okay.
Why, this is one case where I'd like to see Bell and Rogers say, forget it, we're just going to have one, and it's Show Me or it's Crave, and we're going to make sure this works on lots of platforms, because right now there's no Show Me app for Roku. I think there's a Roku app for Crave, because that's ultimately how I'm consuming web-based content or IP-based content. I'm watching it through my Roku for the most part. Even if I'm getting it through YouTube, I'm casting it to my Roku. It's got to work on Roku for me.
I'm wondering how much pressure some of the studios and that are doing to Netflix to basically, you know, crack down on some of this. You have to wonder about that.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure that's a portion of it. Yeah.
I would almost bet that that's exactly where it's coming from, because they worked out these exclusive deals with Bell's and Rogers. And, you know, that's where they see their large market share coming from, is from these exclusive deals, rather than wanting to play with everyone and giving everyone access to content. And I think that's ultimately where it comes down.
Yeah. It's just like other media things where, you know, it's going to be a long road, but yeah, people have to kind of wake up. We're in a global market now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if Disney not give up, but capitulate and make a massive deal with Netflix. Netflix is willing to pay the money. Age of Ultron is already on Netflix Canada.
It was on there for it's been on there for a while.
Yeah, and you know, and that's where all the new Disney, so all the new Marvel and Star Wars stuff is going to be coming for Canada. So I'm very happy with Netflix being able to make deals like that, and that's one reason why I'm like, no, I'm just going to be legit, and I'm going to give my money to Netflix Canada, and I'm going to watch the Canadian content, because to me, it's more fuel for them to say, hey, we have a massive Canadian presence. You want your stuff to be seen here. We have the money and the market share to make sure it does get seen in Canada.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to see what happens here, see how far they crack down. As Jameson said, it could be a cat and mouse game with the VPN. So we'll kind of keep an eye on that and figure out what's going on. Okay, moving on to some home automation. This is something I remember thinking about, you know, ages ago when Nest first came out. Nest smart thermostat outages highlight issues with smart home technology. And I always remember thinking when people were starting to get Nest thermostats and that, I'm saying, because again, I'm a disaster recovery guy. I say, what happens if it loses connection, and what's the standby? And I guess in this case, there were some cases where there was issues and it would like either completely just turn off the furnace or lower the temperature so it was awfully cold. Not good in winter.
No, this is really a massive design flaw. Nest really has to build in some redundancy here so that if their servers go offline or the internet connection goes off, then it just kind of maintains some sort of room temperature, you know, status quo, 21 degrees Celsius, so 72 or Fahrenheit, whatever. Like it needs to just kick into a backup mode until such time that somebody notices, an offline mode, so that somebody notices in the home or at Nest and can fix it.
Yeah.
This is a massive design flaw.
I'm actually really surprised that they don't have something like that, because they've been rather spot on with a lot of their other design choices with things. So the fact that their developers didn't implement some kind of offline mode so that if it loses connectivity, it still has essentially the most recent data dump of what sort of either presets are or a general schedule that can fall back.
I think one of the problems with that is that sometimes, especially with these startup companies, you know, they're so focused on the features and stuff like that, and sometimes they don't have old cranky geeks like me on staff saying, you know, I remember with a storm of 48 when, you know, we had no power for days. So I think that's part of it. Also ties into our next story. We'll get on in a minute. But I think sometimes they don't have someone necessarily saying, okay, what if this happens? What if this happens?
Yeah, so focused on the minimum viable product and not the overall system architecture. Yeah. Which, I mean, granted, the MVP is how you go after and get money, and in this case, getting bought out. But at the same time, we're now what, 3 years into Nest being a
thing?
They
should know. They should know better. I had a friend of ours. She has a Nest smoke alarm, and they had issues, and she couldn't get it turned off, so she had to call the fire department. They came and took care of it. Now, fortunately, in that case, she had a good customer service interaction with Nest, and they did send her a replacement. But again, it kind of shows you these are devices, they're miniature computers, and software can break.
Yeah, and I think this is also kind of a diversity type thing in the sense that Nest is based in California. Mm-hmm. California does not get a lot of variance in their weather compared to Southwestern Ontario. And so when you're part of a global company like Google or Alphabet, and you have the opportunity to send these out to people who you work with, I mean, why wouldn't you? And why wouldn't you solicit their feedback? And maybe that's happening, and I guess nobody thought of it, which is really bad.
I think that's exactly it. I'm sure there's some discussions going on, and I'm hoping at other companies as well that they have stuff. I know, for example, when I was still working at the Roundhouse, we had thermostats from a different company, and they basically, if they lost connection, they'd just stay at the existing temperature they were
at. That's fine. I mean, if I manually set it to 30 degrees, well, that's my problem, right? Like, I will deal with that. But it better to be 30 in the middle of winter than minus 30 or just off. Yeah. So, products like this have to fail gracefully. They absolutely need to.
Yep.
Okay, moving on. Kind of a partially similar story. And again, this is another important thing, particularly when you think about the web's 20 years old and stuff like that. And we have all this digital content we own. We have passwords, Facebook, YouTube, you know, Google Docs, Dropbox, Apple, whatever. Now, this is a case of, you know, and again, it's a case of where some companies don't have processes in place to think about this. Because, again, quite often it's younger staff and things like that. But in this case, Apple, there was a widow, and her husband died, but he had basically the iTunes password. He'd never wrote it down anywhere. And the family had to go through one hell of a lot of loops, and at one point Apple wanted the widow to get a court order, and I think, you know, eventually it sounds like it's being settled, but it's an issue that A, companies have to think about, and B, as users, we should have something in place to kind of think about this, because this is like the combination to safes and stuff like that.
Yeah, but ultimately, the federal government and the provincial government and just about any other company you deal with will happily accept a death certificate in situations like this, right? I'm not going to call Wind or Start Communications in my case, and they're not going to ask me for a court order. Looking for proof of my wife's death or anything like that. A death certificate is usually more than enough, or, you know, maybe confirmation from a lawyer or a funeral home or something at a worst case scenario. And then you move on, right? You get things changed over to your name, and the bill keeps coming in, and you keep paying it because you're using the service or what have you. This is whoever at Apple said that this woman needed a court order is on the moon. Like, this is absolutely ridiculous. And of course, once CBC gets involved, Apple's like, that was a misunderstanding. No, it wasn't. Yep. You got called out on your BS, and now you're trying to fix it.
But as I say, it does give pause for people, you know, and I remember when my mother-in-law passed away, My father-in-law, after that, he kind of created an envelope and had kind of everything, you know, in the one spot. My mom's done that as well, like just, you know, important things like that. And I think it's an important thing, too, with our digital life. Now, I noticed LastPass, password manager I use, they actually now have what they call an emergency mode. You can designate some email addresses, and that if there's been a certain time that they can, let's say I pass away and I put my wife as my, you know, designate. She can then put a request into LastPass, mm-hmm. and based on a time I say, if I haven't gotten back to the request within so long, it will release the master password to her. So that's,
which,
you know,
is reasonable.
People are thinking about it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think it's something that we need to think about. You know, again, the younger ones amongst us don't tend to think about that because we tend to live forever. But,
oh, yeah.
You know, as we get older, you know.
That directed me.
Yeah, no, not at all, younger.
First time father and all that.
But it's an important thing where, you know, it's something to worth think about, like with the rest of the estate planning.
I haven't chimed in yet on this one. I was going to say that I can see it from both sides, because I can see how the wanting to go to court for access to the password is probably too far. But at the same time, I think that companies like Apple do rightfully need to take things like encryption and access to these things at a level like that. Yes, they probably went overboard in this case, but at the same time, they're also trying to go after the American government to say, no, we are not going to put in back doors for government access and things like that. The whole idea of digital encryption and security from that standpoint is too big an issue to just say, you want to know what? Anyone can get access.
Yeah,
I would agree, but what I'm saying is when the person is dead and their next of kin is coming to you with a death certificate saying, hey, my mom's dead, my dad's dead, or in this case, my husband's dead, you know, I had no idea he had a separate password for Apple ID, you know, the iPad just has it stored, and so I can just download whatever games I want. You know, I need to upgrade this, or I need to log into the computer now and get my email or whatever. It's a password. I mean, like, it's an Apple ID account. The worst thing she can do is buy a bunch of stuff.
Well, no, and like I said, I think they went overboard on this, but I do think that I certainly am a little bit comforted knowing that they are thinking about things like thinking about the security of things at that level.
That's good, because they're certainly not thinking through the product design lately.
Yeah, I think there's, as you say, I think there's definitely several failures here, and it just kind of, you know, it brings up several issues we should be reminded of.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on. Speaking of Apple, iOS 9.3, there's a beta coming out. Couple of new features. Jameson, do you have anything in particular, favorites here?
It's kind of a meh. The one thing that really appeals to me is probably the stuff that ties into HealthKit and Health App. It would be nice to see more people, players playing nicely with that, mainly just from the standpoint of I take a look at it as being a great source of data access. Some of the other stuff is a little bit more trivial. It's a 9.3 where we've got 10.0 on the horizon, which is probably going to be unveiled at the Worldwide Developers Conference. And I mean, it's iOS 10, I would expect them to have some good seismic features. Like iOS 9 was good, and it certainly wasn't bad, but it was kind of meh on the terms of great features. So, I don't know. Derek, what are your thoughts on 9.3?
I'm really happy that I'm finally going to be able to pair my multiple $12,000 gold Apple watches with my non-existent iPhone 6S. That also cost me $1,000. This is This is such a 1% problem. Like,
now we should state for our audience in the pre-show on this, he had a much better way of expressing this, but we have to save that for the rated R version.
Yeah, no, I'm keeping it PG. I'm keeping it G right now, actually, except for the sarcasm.
Awesome.
Yeah, so in the iOS 9.3 beta, you can pair multiple Apple Watches with your iPhone. I didn't know that this was a problem.
Apparently it is.
We should ask some of our Apple Watch people out there if they have several of them now. Maybe they have one for each time zone.
Like, I'm not, unless you're Leo Laporte, or you know what? This, I think the code name for this feature was Kanye.
Mm-hmm.
Like, or Jay-Z. Like,
or Dr.
come on.
Dre.
Yes, yeah. Sure. Yeah, code name 100%. Feature, or feature code name Dre. Or Drake, better yet. No, but seriously, how many people have multiple Apple Watches that they need to pair with one iPhone? If you have enough money to buy an iPhone and to blow another $400 or $500 on an Apple Watch and probably a custom strap, are you really at a point where you have multiple Apple Watches that you need to pair with the same phone? First of all, it could be paired with an iPad instead, which is a lot more likely. That you have in your home, like an iPhone and an iPad. So
I'm going to take this one segment of yours, Derek, and we're going to invite our audience to like have some fun with it. Because
sure,
you know.
Sure, please
no,
have all the fun you want. I'm happy to be part of a meme.
I agree wholeheartedly, but yeah, we could make a meme for you. There is one thing I do like, and that's the night shift mode. I use an app called Flux on my Mac, and this matches that. So basically what it does is it shifts the light more to a more orange light once the sun goes down, and it's supposed to help things better. Now, we all should say is we shouldn't be looking at our screens right just before bed anyway.
Messing with your circadian rhythm.
Yeah, I do find when I'm working, ever since I put Flux on, I do notice a bit of a difference with it. So yeah, that'll be interesting to try. I haven't updated yet, but yeah, it'll be interesting to try.
I was going to say, I do want to say one thing. I am a little bit disappointed with Apple with their treatment of the developer of Flux, actually, in their revocation of the iOS app. And just flat out removing it from the store. I think that's a little bit, that's cold.
Once again,
it hasn't been the first time Apple's done something like that.
No, and it won't be the last. Unfortunately, Apple has this thing, and I'm sure Google is guilty of it as well, but certainly not nearly as often, of copying a developer or an independent developer's feature and then promptly telling that developer to go away.
Yep.
It's really rude. You know, if I am on an iPhone 4S... or, you know, an iPhone 5, maybe it's not going to get iOS 9.3. I was really smart and didn't upgrade my iPhone 4S to iOS 9 because then it loads really slowly. You know, I should still be able to allow, or I should be able to keep Flux or download Flux at a later date on my phone without Apple deciding for me that it's not cool anymore or that it has to be baked into the OS.
Exactly.
Another reason why I have no plans to buy any Apple hardware anytime soon.
Okay. So you have plans. So that means you have your Android phone, right?
I have my Android phone. I still have my iPad, iPad Mini 2. However, I'm less and less impressed every time I get a new version of iOS because iOS 9, for some silly reason, removed the ability for me to full screen video in the podcasts app.
That's weird. Very
nothing odd. will make a video full screen, and that's extremely annoying. So anyway,
yes, it is. Okay, well, Android's Google, and this is my vain attempt at a segue.
sorry,
pretty bad. I know it was a stretch.
No, I messed it up too. It's my bad.
That's all right, man. That's all right. So and even this is a stretch. In semi-local news, up the 401, our good friends up in Kitchener, Google's opened a brand new headquarters here, in again.
Stuart. Okay,
I think every time, right?
Oh, we lost Stuart. So I'm gonna give him a minute to.
That was fun.
Yeah, so I'll take over here. So Google Canada opened up a brand new headquarters in Kitchener. I have to remind the Globe and Mail and anybody else reading the story: Kitchener, Waterloo is not a thing. Kitchener is a city unto itself, and Waterloo is a smaller city unto itself, just north of Kitchener. They do butt up against each other, as do Kitchener and Cambridge, but nobody ever calls it Kitchener-Cambridge or Waterloo-Kitchener-Cambridge.
I can tell this is a thing for you.
It is a thing for me. I lived in Kitchener for a year. It's a beautiful city. So is Waterloo. So is Cambridge. But although they are all part of the region of Waterloo, you know, oversight government, it is Kitchener-Waterloo is not a thing. It is just like the Globe and Mail calling us a town.
Let's just go ahead and call it the Tri-City and move back to the story.
Sure. So they opened up a new engineering office in Kitchener. It is also the new Google Canada headquarters, and it is very, very nice. It is very Silicon Valley style thing. They have an indoor rock climbing wall, which I want to try out. They have this place called the Blue Library that has a very cool looking wooden caribou on the wall that looks like it's ready for war.
Looks like a cyborg.
It does look like a cyborg caribou.
It's a moose.
Yeah. Moose, caribou. Once they're that size, they can destroy my car. So, yeah, it just looks very, very nice. My everybody here at Olio would like to work in the office. So now we have to scheme a way for people to acquire us. And, yeah, 185,000.
That's always a good thing.
Yeah, 185,000 square feet. They're leasing this space for at least 10 years, so it looks great.
It's definitely gorgeous. I mean, here at Arcane, we just moved into our new building. We're still fleshing it out. I hope that when our building is all said and done, I want it to be just as nice as that is. So, if you take a look at where sort of offices are, office technology and culture is going, I think companies like Google really do have a down pat where, you know, the whole cubicle is not where people want to work. It's not conducive. It may be conducive to certain types of work, but for anything that's even remotely creative, you need to have space like this that allows you to not be locked into a 4x4 cube with walls around you.
Exactly. So, a good mix of things. So, congratulations to them. They had the opening. They included a visit from our brand new Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau. So that's always good.
Mm-hmm.
Getting some things there. So, okay, moving on to what we like, and I'm going to start this week. I found one. It's called Snagit, and it's a plugin for Chrome. Now, years and eons ago, when I worked in the big corporate world and I was doing a lot of documentation, Snagit was this great Windows app, and it allowed you to do screenshots, and you could basically pre-configure it by a bunch of hotkeys. So you could do like a region, a screen, you could auto rename stuff like that to a file. It really made, you know, when you were like planning documentation and going through a series of steps really easy. And I hadn't used the program in a while, and I'm working on my a brand new e-guide, which has a lot of screenshots, and I found the plugin, and this is great. It's a neat little plugin for Chrome, and there's a hotkey. It's limited to what it does unless you buy the full-on paid app, but for what I need it for, it screenshots images, automatically saves them to my Google Drive, and it works really, really well. So definitely well recommended, particularly, like I say, if you're doing documentation or you need to screenshot some steps. There's even a video mode. I haven't played with that yet, but definitely well worth a look.
How much does the full version cost?
I haven't actually, because the plugin's not the full version. There's actually a separate app, and I haven't looked at that in ages. So I do confess I haven't. I know when we had it at my former place, we bought a site license. It was like $50, but it's one of those things, if you need it, you need it badly, it's worth it.
Yeah, I'm actually just looking now.
Single user is $49.95.
Yeah, there you go.
They actually have Canadian pricing here, $60.
There you go. Perfect. Yeah. No, it's something if you're going to use a lot of and you want a few more options, like when I was at my, like I said, my former corporate job, you could set it so, okay, go into this directory and automatically number them starting at 01.
Right. Oh.
So it made it really nice, that sort of
that
stuff.
Would
yeah,
be
you
nice.
Could, yeah, you could set up things like auto, you know, always do the active window or always do a region, stuff like that. This one, you have a few less options, but for what I need it for and for the price, it's awesome.
Cool.
Very cool.
Okay.
Eric. Mine is a, speaking of VPNs and Netflix earlier, yeah, mine is a VPN service called ProXPN. I actually have a premium account for this, so I have unrestricted bandwidth. ProXPN is fairly unique in the VPN service world because they don't keep logs. So they don't keep logs of what you do or, you know, or like, you know, obviously you need to connect because you need to authenticate if you're paying for it to differentiate you from the free accounts. But otherwise, they don't actually keep track of what you do. So they can't prove that you use the BBC iPlayer or even that you were doing some white hat hacking or anything like that. They don't monitor it. They don't keep logs. That was at the advice of Steve Gibson, who is a well-known security researcher and podcaster. And and they actually have servers all over the world, places like London, Amsterdam, Singapore, a few U.S. locations. I think they have a Canadian location for people who are trying to look like they're from Canada. So if you're looking for a way to... you know, encrypt your browsing, prevent websites from knowing who you are or what sort of activity you're doing, or even prevent your ISP from keeping logs on what you're doing,
right.
Which, you know, if you're in, let's say, Turkey or Syria or even in the U.S., that could be an issue for you. Definitely try out the free version. It goes up to 300 kilobits a second, which is not bad. It's faster than, several times faster than dial-up. And if you like it, it's actually really inexpensive for an entire quarter. It's like $23. So, $625 US per month. So for what you get, it's really, it works. And it's cross-platform, Windows, macOS, iOS, and Android.
That I like. I like. All right, Jameson, what have you got?
Well, you know me. I'm a sucker for productivity stuff.
You found yet another productivity software.
Yes, and actually this one, happy to note, I was thinking about doing it this week, and a couple of days ago I got into the closed iOS beta for it.
What's it called?
It's called AirMail, and it's on. If you take a look at sites like the Suite Setup and places like that, it highly, highly ranks as one of the best email programs out there for Mac. I've been using it on my personal laptop. I'm going to be setting it up on my work one shortly. It does a lot of things really nicely. And I started to look for something when it was announced that Mailbox was going to be shut down by Dropbox. Mailbox I was using at work for my email. I really fell in love with the swipes. I also loved the fact that I had a unified app, not only on my desktop, but also on my mobile devices. So I started to search for one and looked for a bunch of different things. You know, found some that were great on desktop and not so good on mobile, or great on desktop and good on mobile, but didn't offer any free trials or anything like that. I happily will shell out $20 or $30 for an app, but not if I can't test it first. And then I came across AirMail. They handle trials really well. You download their nightly beta and you can try it out for a while and see if it works for you. Obviously it's a little bit slower because it's a beta and there's debug code, etc. But I've started to play around with it on desktop and absolutely love it. And now that I'm in the iOS beta, it has all of the best features of Mailbox for swipes and for setting up, customizing things the way you want them to, and more as far as I've found. It handles multiple accounts in sort of a unified inbox really well, notifying you which accounts are sending you mail and all these different things. The desktop app is, I believe, $11.99 here in Canada or $9.99 in the US. It's phenomenal. I highly recommend it. As much as, you know, the stock mail app for OS X is good, it just does things a little bit better, including things like snoozing and all of the, you know, different ways of treating your inbox like a to-do list. Mm-hmm. And with the addition of a very solid iOS app, I think it's a great combination so that you've got all of your devices using the same program, the same setup, and working the way you want it to.
Cool. No, it looks interesting. You'll have to let us know what you think about it further down the road.
Definitely will.
All right. Well, I think that's it for today. We managed to keep well under our marathon show last week. So we're about 46 minutes. But again, thank you all for joining us today. Thank you, gentlemen. And for the Canadian Tech Podcast for Wednesday, January the 20th, 2016, my name is Stuart Clark.
This is Derek Silva coming to you live from Audio Digital Labs.
I had to get the plug in there. I'm Jason Roberts, live from Arcane Digital.
Thank you, and be well.